prices next to products, so shoppers could easily do a comparison for the best value. The superfluous transparency of food manufacturers, who not only attractively packaged products from cornflakes to tea to canned meats, but also provided information on what was and wasn't in the food. Some manufacturers going as far as supplying details on what the product could and couldn't do to a body. No matter what time of day she went, regardless of how many people were in the store, she found the shopping experience fascinating and weirdly serene. Almost unlike what a market shopping experience should be. Completely unlike the Limbe market. Which was why she missed the exuberance and disorderliness of her hometown's open-air market. As much as she loved Pathmark, shopping there made her wish she could be back in the midst of the spectacle that happened on Tuesdays and Fridays in her hometown. Those were the days when the stalls that were only half full on other days filled up with smoked fish and crayfish on one end, plantains and cocoyams and vegetables on another end, and with secondhand clothes from Douala next to the flesh of cows slaughtered that morning. She missed the early morning rush to get the freshest produce, and the pushing and shoving of married women determined to pick the best Okrika clothes for their husbands and children. She missed the pleas from traders asking shoppers to choose them over competitors, and the cunning bargaining that ensued between buyers and sellers. "How much for this bunch plantains?" a buyer would ask. "Give me 3,000, my sister," the seller would say. 3,000? Why? "I give you 700. "No, my sister, 700 no correct. I beg. Give me 1,800. "No, I'll go give you 950. If you no want, I'll go leave 'em." "Okay, okay, take 'em. I do only give you for this price because I don't ready for go house." "Eh, see you, corny man." "No be corny, my sister, not true. I no go make any profit today. But how man go do?" Ah, Limbe market. She missed the joy of walking away, knowing she had negotiated a good deal for a bag of rice. There was no haggling in Pathmark. The owners stated the prices, and no one dared challenge them. It was as if they were a supreme deity, which was a pity, because if she could bargain, she would find a way to make her new grocery budget work. Her family now had to eat a lot of chicken gizzards and save drumsticks for special occasions. Leomi would soon have to start eating Puff Puff for breakfast instead of Honey Nut Cheerios, and Jende would need to start drinking less Mountain Dew and more water. As for herself, she would have to hold on tightly to the memories of the shrimp she'd had in the Hamptons, because until good money started coming in again, there would be no shrimp dinners, not even on Sundays and holidays. Thinking of shrimp as she walked through the store made her think of Anna and the brunch they had worked together. Cindy had told them that they could take home the leftovers, and Anna had let her take all the food, including the bacon-wrapped shrimp, which she, Jende, and Leomi had rapturously finished off that evening. It was also thanks to Anna that she'd had such a successful experience working for the Edwardses. Anna had called her back every time she'd left a message saying she didn't know how to execute an order Cindy had given. Thinking of all this made Nenny wish she and Anna had become friends, but she knew it was no longer possible. Any chance of a friendship blossoming had ended the last time they spoke.
"What did you do to Cindy last night?"
Anna had said without prelude when she called just before 6 o'clock the morning after Nenny left the Edwards apartment. She appeared to be on the train, on her way to work.
"Anna?"
Nenny whispered groggily, rising from the bed to go to the living room so as not to awaken her children.
"I say, what you do to Cindy yesterday?"
Anna repeated.
"I want to know."
Nenny sat on the sofa, her hands on her left breast, which was heavy and painful from too much milk, thanks to Timba starting to sleep through the night at 2 months old.
"I don't understand what you want to know," she said to Anna. "I want to know why you come to the house yesterday. What you say to Cindy, why she scream for me to call 911. I try to call you after you leave, but I only get your voice message."
"I had to get home to my children," Nenny said.
"Okay. You with your children now? So tell me, what happened with you and Cindy?"
Nenny took a deep breath and shook her head, The audacity of Anna calling at 6 in the morning to interrogate her.
You know what, Anna?
She said, looking at the bedroom door to make sure it was closed.
I don't like to say this to people, because I don't like it when other people say it to me. But it is not your business.
Yes, it is my business,
Anna quickly replied.
How is it your business what happens between me and Mrs. Edwards? I have my relationship with her. You have your own relationship.
If someone come to this house and do something to any of these people it concern me, I work for them. I make sure I do everything I can so they're happy. You come here last night. You leave. You know what happened after.
What?
I want to know what you do to her.
Anna said again.
We had an agreement about something, and I only went to remind her of agreement.
Agreement for what?
Anna, please.
You leave this house and the woman lock herself in bathroom and cry alone for 2 hours.
Anna said, her voice rising slightly in the train.
I try to go to her. She shout at me to leave her alone. She say the F word to me. Over and over, she say F to me, F to we all. Leave her alone. What I do? Maybe she thinks what you did to her was me and you who did it together.
I don't.
I call Stacy, beg her to take Mighty somewhere after hockey so he don't see his mother like this. I don't want him to hear Cindy crying in the bathroom because you do something to her.
Please. Don't make it as if it's my fault, okay?
Oh, so it's not your fault? It's not anyone's fault. You know she got problems,
Anna said, each word coming out angrier than the preceding one.
You know how many problems she got?
Wait, you think I don't have problems too? Do you know how many problems I have?
So you come yesterday for Cindy to solve your problems. That's why I see you smile as you leave. Because you make the woman cry after she solved.
I did not come for anyone to solve my problems. If I have things that I am not happy with, I find a way to make them better. I solve my own problems.
You think because
I don't think anything,
Nanny said.
If Mrs. Edwards is not happy with her life, let her solve her own problems. I am tired of people wanting me to care about them more than I care about myself and my family.
Nobody asks you not to care for yourself.
Yes, you and Mrs. Edwards do. That is what you called me this morning to say. To make me feel bad because Mrs. Edwards has big problems and I should worry about her.
I only want to know. I'm sorry, Anna. But if Mrs. Edwards wants to change her life, then let her go find a way to be happy. And I hope she finds a way to be happy very soon, because I feel really sorry for her.
Chapter 44. At the center of the platform, between 2 full benches, a man in a wheelchair was singing for dollars and cents.
The answer, oh babe,
he sang in a raspy voice,
is gonna be blowing in the wind. The answer be blowing in the wind. Oh yeah, the answer, sweet and babe, is gonna be blowing in the wind.
No one appeared to be listening or watching as he moved his harmonica to his mouth and blew into it with his eyes closed, nodding to the splendor of his own music. At least 2 people were looking up the tracks, murmuring to themselves, one asking when the damn train was ever going to arrive.
Amen, my brother, someone said when the song ended. A to the men indeed,
another voice added, making it clear that more than 1 person had been listening. Many on Nenny's side of the platform nodded. Some applauded. Nenny applauded, too, and put 50 cents in the man's cup in appreciation of his ability to compose such a beautiful original song.
When she arrived at the church office, the assistant pastor ushered her into a conference room where a box of letters and envelopes was sitting on the table.
"I can't thank you enough for stopping by," he said as he showed her how to fold the fundraising letters and stuff them into the envelopes. "We're badly in need of volunteers."
"I am glad I can help," Nanny said. "I did not know if you needed any help when I called this morning."
"No, it's perfect timing. Where's the baby?"
"I left her at home with my friend. I just wanted to go out alone for a little bit."
"Understandable. I'm not sure I can handle the monotony of being home with a baby every day."
"Is Natasha in today?"
"She's at an interfaith conference, but she should be back in about an hour. I'll let her know you're in here when she comes back."
45 minutes later, Natasha peeked in from the hallway.
"Nanny, how sweet of you to come out to help," she said.
"Hi, Natasha.
I need to get some work done right now, but drop by before you leave. Let's catch up, okay?"
Alone in the conference room, Nanny folded the letters twice and slid them into the yellow pre-addressed envelopes, trying not to think about her conversation with Anna the previous morning. The woman had upset her so much, she was still fuming a day later.
"What have you been up to?"
Natasha asked, motioning to a chair at her desk when Nanny entered her office to say goodbye.
"Everything is good," Nanny said.
"Kids are good? Your husband?"
Nanny nodded.
"You're enjoying the new year so far?"
"I'm okay."
Natasha looked at her dubiously, stood up, and closed the door.
"How are you really?" she asked. "What's the situation with your husband's papers?"
"I'm trying not to worry about it, but it's not easy."
"Any new developments?"
"We are still just waiting and hoping. But one of my friends, she told me about a solution that can help us."
"That's wonderful. What's the solution?"
"I don't know if you will like it."
"It's not for me to like, Nanny," Natasha said with a smile. "It's for me to listen to you and help you listen to your heart."
"I haven't even told my husband."
"I understand. You don't have to tell me if you don't feel comfortable."
Nanny looked at Natasha's reassuring smile and decided she might as well.
"My friend," she said quietly, "she has a cousin."
"Mm-hmm."
"I can marry him."
"Marry him?"
Nanny nodded.
"I can get a green card through him if I marry him."
I see."
I have to divorce my husband for a few years. Then I can marry my friend's cousin, and he will file papers for me."
Natasha nodded, pulling a scrunchie from her wrist to put her hair in a ponytail. She stood up and walked to a water cooler by the door.
"You want a cup of water?"
she asked Nanny. Nanny shook her head and watched as Natasha filled a disposable cup and downed the water in one gulp.
"Refreshing,"
the pastor said with a broad smile as she tossed the cup into a garbage can and retook her seat. Nanny waited, the beating of her heart suddenly noticeable to her.
"You're thinking of marrying another man for a few years," Natasha said.
"It's my friend's idea. Only I don't know if it is right or wrong."
"Oh, I think we're way past the point of right and wrong," Natasha said, chuckling.
"Someone I know used to say that to me a lot."
"Rumi."
"Who?"
"Jalaluddin Rumi, the Sufi mystic. He's the one who said, out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there."
Which was his own way of saying, "Let's not dwell too much on labeling things as right or wrong."
"But everything in life is either right or wrong."
"Is it?"
"It's not."
"Why would you want to divorce your husband and risk your marriage for papers, Nanny?"
"Why?"
"Is America that important to you?"
"Is it more important to you than your family?"
Nanny lowered her eyes and stared at the floor. She could hear pedestrians on Thompson Street, chatting
as they walked past Natasha's office window. So much could go wrong with this plan, Natasha said.
That's what I told my friend when she suggested it to me. Because I have another friend from work, and her sister did the same thing. She left her husband and children back in their country and came to America and married a Jamaican man for papers so she could bring her husband and children here. But when everything was finished, the Jamaican man refused to give her divorce unless she gave him more money. He wants $50,000.
That's awful.
Yes, because now she cannot go back to her country and marry her husband back and bring her family here. She's over here, and they are still over there, and the woman is just praying that the Jamaican man will stop being so greedy, because she really needs to be with her husband and children.
And knowing a story like this, you're still willing to take the risk.
My friend's cousin is a nice man.
Oh, I bet. And the Jamaican man is in all likelihood a wonderful man.
I just don't know what to do,
Nani said. Sometimes, the best thing to do is nothing. Nani feigned a smile. Doing nothing was not an option, but it wouldn't be respectful to contradict Natasha. Besides, it was best she stopped talking about their papier situation, lest she say something Jende wouldn't want revealed.
The guy who used to talk to me about right and wrong, she said, attempting to change the topic, he has a little brother who hated doing nothing.
We don't like doing nothing in this country. Nani and Natasha laughed together.
I used to work for the boy's family, and I was always doing something with the younger one, but I liked it. He was very funny. One time, I took him to a play date with his friend, and his friend's mother offered him some food, and he said, no thanks. He was not going to eat anything because he preferred to eat my food when we got home. He thought I was the best cook.
I bet he's right, Natasha said, to which Nani smiled. That night, while Leomi was counting and tickling Timba's toes, Nani sent Mighty an email. Within seconds, a response came back. Sorry, we were unable to deliver your message to the following address, Mighty, the Mighty One, at yahoo.com. This user doesn't have a yahoo.com account. Below this line is a copy of the message. Hi, Mighty. How are you? How is school? I hope you are being a good boy and obeying your father and your mother. I heard your mother is not feeling very well. Remember what I told you, that mothers are the most special things in the world. So be nice to your mother. Take care, Nani.
Chapter 45. Cindy Eliza Edwards died on a cold afternoon in March 2009, alone in her marital bed, 5 weeks after Nani Jonga walked out of her apartment. Her husband was in London on a business trip as she lay dying. Her firstborn son was in India, walking the path to enlightenment. Her younger son was at the Dalton School, being groomed to become a man like his father. Her father, whose identity neither she nor her mother ever knew, had been dead for 2 decades. Her mother, who she believed loved her too little, had been gone for 4 years. Her half-sister, completely out of her life since the death of their mother, was still in Falls Church, Virginia, living a life of material comfort, better than the one they had lived together as children, but far less comfortable than the one Cindy had been living in New York City. Her friends were all over Manhattan, shopping at Saks and Barney's, lunching and drinking fine wine, planning dinner parties and galas, attending meetings for charities, looking forward to their next vacation to an exotic locale.
But I don't understand,
Nani said over and over, as Winston recounted to her and Jende everything he knew based on the story Frank had told him that evening, a day after the passing. Asphyxiation due to vomit, Frank had said, according to the medical examiner. High levels of opioid and alcohol had been found in her body, leading the examiner to believe she had swallowed multiple Vicodin pills, drunk at least 2 bottles of wine, fallen asleep, and accidentally drowned in her own vomit.
Anna had discovered her, lying flat on the bed, her arms flung wide and hanging stiff off the bed, her eyes and mouth open, dried vomit crusted on her chin, neck, and the neckline of her silk nightgown. With Clark out of town, Anna had immediately called Frank, screaming and crying. Frank couldn't get out of an important meeting at work, so he had asked his wife Mimi to hurry to the Edwards apartment. Mimi had gone there and found their friend dead.
"Oh, Papa God," Nanny cried. "But how could she die that kind of useless death?"
Jende asked.
"Why didn't she go to the doctor? She had all that money, and she died in her own bed. Why didn't one of her friends try to force her? Why didn't anyone see that there was something wrong with her? What kind of country is this?"
According to Frank, Winston said, Cindy had closed the blinds on the world. Even Mimi, who was one of her good friends, had not seen her in months. Mimi had to show up at the Edwards apartment unannounced after weeks of her calls and emails not being returned, and after having almost a dozen three-way phone conversations with Cherie and June, who were restless and increasingly apprehensive because they couldn't understand why Cindy wouldn't tell them what was going on. The women had agreed that Cindy needed an intervention, and Mimi, 3 days before Cindy's death, had walked into Cindy's bedroom with Anna's encouragement. There, she had seen her friend ashen and limp, near broken, in a white silk nightgown, sitting on her bed and staring at nothing in particular. Cindy had told her she was living in a darkness she couldn't get out of, and Mimi had begged her to please go see a psychiatrist, because she appeared to be dealing with a severe case of depression. Cindy had refused, saying she wasn't depressed, but Mimi had pleaded for her to at least do it for the sake of her children. "Think about Mighty," Mimi had said. "Think about how it must feel for him to see his mother like this." Cindy had cried and, for her son's sake, agreed to go to a treatment center outside Boston, because with the end of her marriage seeming inevitable, her son in India not returning her calls and emails, her whole life beginning to seem more and more meaningless, she needed to do something now if she ever hoped to taste happiness again. She made Mimi promise not to tell anyone what they'd discussed, not even Frank, not even Cherie or June. She was going to apologize to everyone for ignoring their calls and emails, and tell them everything, as soon as she felt better. Nanny's hand remained on her chest throughout the story, her mouth agape. When Winston was done recounting it, she wiped the tears that had been running down her cheeks with the hem of her skirt.
"Should I call Mr. Edwards tonight?" Jende asked.
"No," Winston said. "Maybe in a few weeks or months. Too much is happening for them right now. Frank only told me all this because I saw him when he stopped by the office on his way to pick Clark up from the airport. He'll let me know when the date for the memorial service is, and I'll let you know."
Jende shook his head sadly.
"But how is Mr. Edwards going to manage?"
"Frank said the man was crying so hard over the phone," Winston said. "It sounds like no matter what happened between them, he truly loved his wife."
Chapter 46. Mighty Edwards wore a gray suit and played a beautifully imperfect Claude Debussy's Clair de Lune at the memorial service, which took place a week later. In the front pew, Clark sat with his sunglasses on. The mourners, all 200 or so of them, sat glum under the 100-foot-high roof of the Church of St. Paul the Apostle, on the corner of 60th Street and Columbus Avenue. Around them were depictions of the Savior and the Holy Mother. Above them, two rows of pendant lighting, and to their right, on a little table, a prayer book, where all who were burdened, all who were weary, all who were broken-hearted, could leave prayer requests and pleas for blessings. The priest thanked God for loving Cindy Edwards and calling her to spend eternity with him. "What a great rejoicing must be happening in heaven," he said. After the congregation had sung, "Nearer, my God, to thee,"
and a soloist had sung Peace, Perfect Peace. Frank and Mimi's daughter, Nora Dawson, in a black, body-fitting, long-sleeved mini-dress, her blonde hair blow-dried straight like that of her deceased godmother on some of the best days of her life, walked to the altar and read from John chapter 14, verses 1 to 3, Jesus' promise to his disciples.
Do not let your hearts be troubled, she said. Believe in God. Believe also in me. My Father's house has many rooms. If that were not so, would I have told you that I am going there to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, so that wherever I am, there you will be also. Amen.
When the moment for eulogy arrived, after the priest had assured the mourners in his message that indeed Jesus had prepared a special room for Cindy in heaven, after communion had been served, after Cherie had read a poem she'd commissioned titled, No One Warned Me Loving You Would Leave Me This Broken, Vince Edwards stood up and walked to the front. He had no sheet from which he read. He spoke in anecdotes of the mother who roughhoused with him with her pearls on back when he was a little boy. Of the mother who took him hiking in the Adirondacks just so she could lose her last 10 ounces of belly fat. Cindy's clients, models and actresses who had filled a pew in the center of the church, giggled. He spoke of his mother's passion for healthy living, her commitment to her clients to help them eat better, have better lives, look better, and be better because they looked better. He spoke of her love for her friends, her love for those who needed her. He spoke of her love for the arts, the forced trips to the Met, her failed attempts to get him to learn the violin, her successful attempts to get Mighty to play the piano, so he could one day show the world his talent at Carnegie Hall. Someone in the front clapped. Others joined. Vince bowed his head and cleared his throat. He looked up and smiled at the congregation.
He spoke about the mother whom he had been so blessed to have. She was imperfect, he said. Flawed, yes, but beautiful. So beautiful, like we all are.
In the last pew, Jende closed his eyes and prayed for Cindy's soul to rest in peace. From where he sat, a somber black face surrounded by somber white faces, he could see the red vase holding the ashes of the woman who, until some weeks before, used to hand him a check to buy his daily bread. The woman who had given his nieces and nephews a year of education, and his son a suit from Brooks Brothers. He could see half of the back of Clark's head, and the top of the white mop of hair belonging to Clark's mother. He couldn't see Mighty's head, but his eyes had welled up with tears as he watched the boy ascend the steps to sit at the piano. He'd felt sorry not only for the woman in the vase, but also for the young boy, the cheerful child he'd spent many mornings driving to school, a child who now had to live with the shame brought on by the nature of his mother's death.
I looked at him, and I thought, what is this poor child going to do?
He said to Nanny as they lay in bed facing each other that night. Nanny did not respond.
It's not your fault, he said. I keep on telling you that. It was Mrs. Edwards' time to go.
You think you are helping someone by keeping their secret?
You helped her.
I didn't help her.
She sat up, her breast pads peeking out of her nursing bra.
Let's give the money to the church,
she said in a tearful voice. He turned from his side to his back, looking at the ceiling.
I think we should give the money away, she said again.
You women are something else, eh?
He said, chuckling and shaking his head.
It's not a woman thing, she snapped.
Your guilt will soon go away.
If I had known she was dying.
She would have died either way, okay?
He said, his eyes closed, his voice trailing off.
Whether or not she gave you the money, she would have died.
Chapter 47. Though she'd heard of honor societies, she didn't know what they did. So when she received a letter from Phi Theta Kappa inviting her to become a member, she immediately called Betty.
"It means you are smarter,"
Betty said.
"Really?"
"Yes, madame, really.
They only invite people who have good grades. Why are you acting surprised?"
"As if you don't know, there's a good brain inside that oblong head of yours."
"Jealousy will kill you, Betty," Nani said, laughing.
"Right after it kills you."
When Jende came home that night, she showed him the letter, concerned about what he would say about the $100 application fee, but excited for him to see the validation of her academic prowess, thanks to him working hard to send her to school.
"I don't even know if I should bother trying to join," she said, feigning disinterest.
"But this is good, Bebe," he said.
"The letter says you are one of the top students in your college. Why didn't you tell me that? Even with you not going to school this semester, they're still thinking of you."
"So I can spend the $100 to join?"
"Spend $300, he said,
wrapping his arms around her waist and kissing her.
"If there ever was a reason to pinch out a little something from the savings, this is it. If you can join and get one of the scholarships that they say they give to their members..."
"That's the same thing I was thinking. The scholarships. Imagine, Bebe, if I could get a scholarship to help us pay for September, or even January, wouldn't that be something?"
"Maybe I'll finally know again what it's like to have a good night's sleep."
The next day, she submitted her membership application online, and days later received an envelope welcoming her to the society and telling her about all the benefits. She immediately went to the website the letter directed her to, and there she saw the scholarships. Dozens of scholarships for students with her grade point average, and students with her level of progress, and students with her major and career interest. For most of the scholarships, though, the deadline had passed. For the ones whose deadlines were still open, she needed to be nominated by a dean.
"Then go see the dean and beg him to nominate you," Jende said after she told him what she'd discovered.
"But I don't know any dean,"
she said, trying not to get upset at his patronizing tone.
"You go to your school, Nani, and ask someone who this dean who nominates people is. You go to the man and tell him your situation, okay? You tell the man that you have to return to school in September to remain legal in the country. Tell him you are very smart and you want to be a pharmacist, but your husband doesn't make good money anymore. Let him know how bad you want to be a pharmacist and how bad your husband wants you to be a pharmacist. You have to say anything you can, because you don't know if the man is going to have a soft heart."
She listened, nodded, and an hour later emailed her former pre-calculus instructor, who wrote back the next morning with the name and office number of the nominator, Dean Flipkins. The instructor told her she didn't need an appointment to see the dean. She could go there any time. That afternoon, she took Timba to Betty's, hoping to see the dean so she could get her scholarship as soon as possible. On the walk from the subway to the school, she imagined the dean as a kindly old white man with a head of sparse gray hair. But when she got there, she realized she had visualized incorrectly. He was a white man, but young, with a head of thick brown hair, and within a minute of being in his office, she could tell his heart wasn't nearly as soft as Jende had hoped it would be.
"I'm sorry to disappoint you, Miss Janga," he said to her, "but I don't nominate by request. I nominate students with stellar grades who are making a contribution to the college and their community."
"I understand, Dean," Nani said collectedly,
trying not to sound as desperate as she was.
"But you can see I have very good grades, which is why I came here to see you today."
"I see your grades, all right. But what about your involvement in the college and the community? Are you a member of any organization on campus? Have you done anything to enrich the lives of other students at BMCC?"
"Dean, I have..."
"Do you volunteer at any organization in the city, in your neighborhood?"
Nani shook her head.
"I volunteered at my church one time, but I really would like to volunteer more, Dean.
she said, suddenly feeling ashamed, as if she'd been caught stealing.
It's just that I have no time, Dean.
No one has time, Miss Junger, the dean said.
I have two children, and before my second child was born, I was also working. If I had any time, I would be so glad to do something for BMCC because I like the school. But without the time, Dean, I just cannot do anything.
I'm not sure what to tell you.
I need any kind of help, Dean Flipkins. I only have two more semesters before I can transfer to four-year college. But my husband, he lost his job that pays good money. I really don't know how I can come back to school in September if someone doesn't help me with a scholarship. If there's anything you can do to help me.
The dean stared at her through his geek-chic black-framed glasses, then turned toward his computer. He couldn't be less than her age, Nenny estimated, though he looked much younger, quite like the flawless-skinned and neatly coiffed young men in the billboards that floated over Times Square. Nenny couldn't help thinking he was sitting in that office only because he had to, not because he wanted to. And that was enough to make her believe the man wouldn't care if she had to drop out of BMCC. As he moved his mouse around the pad, she watched his hands, well-manicured and soft-looking, the hands of someone who'd never known a day of hard labor.
I would send you over to financial aid, he said, turning his attention back to her. But I see here you're an international student. I'm sure you know that pretty much every scholarship or grant we offer is for citizens or permanent residents. So there really isn't much they can do for you.
Nenny nodded, buttoning her jacket and reaching down for her purse lying on the floor.
Though I must ask you, Miss Junger, he went on, ignoring Nenny's attempt to end the meeting. I see here that your plan after graduation is to apply to pharmacy school. Is that still the case?
Nenny nodded, not wanting to waste any more words with him.
May I ask, why pharmacy?
I like pharmacy, she briskly replied.
I understand, but why?
Because I want to give people medicine to feel better. When I came to America, my husband's cousin advised me to do it, that it's a very good thing to study, and everyone tells me that it's a good job. Is there a problem with me trying to become a pharmacist, Dean?
The dean smiled, and Nenny imagined he was derisively laughing at her inwardly, at the impassioned manner in which she'd just defended her career choice.
Everyone who told you pharmacy is a great career is right, he said, still smiling haughtily. But I wonder, and I hate saying this to students, because I don't want anyone to think I'm asking them to dream small. Have you wondered if it is the right career path for someone in your circumstances?
I don't understand what you mean.
I'm simply wondering, Miss Junger, if perhaps another career path may be better suited for someone like you.
I want to be a pharmacist, Nenny said,
no longer trying to disguise her anger.
That's great. And I commend you for that, but you came here today because you are desperate for money to finish school. You have two children, your husband doesn't make enough money, and by all accounts, you're having a hard time making ends meet. Pharmacy school is very expensive, Miss Junger, and you're an international student. Unless you change your legal status, it's going to be hard for you to get loans to get the degree. If you can find a way to get your associates from BMCC in the first place.
So you are telling me you think I should not try to be a pharmacist?
The dean took off his glasses, placed them on the desk.
One of my duties as associate dean of students, he said, is to offer our students career counseling. And my aim when I counsel students like you, Miss Junger, is to guide them toward achievable goals. Do you understand what that means, for a goal to be achievable?
Nenny glared on without a word.
There are lots of other great careers in the healthcare field, and we can help you get into those. Licensed practical nurse, ultrasound technician, medical billing and coding. Lots of great careers which, you know,
which will be more achievable?
I don't want achievable.
It would be a shame for you to spend years pursuing a goal which you have such little chance of achieving, don't you think? I just want to talk it out and see what the odds are of you, you know, graduating from BMCC, getting into pharmacy school, and becoming a licensed pharmacist while dealing with financial stress, raising two children, and living in the country on a temporary visa. Don't you think it would be a shame to start something, spend time and money, only to give it up later because you realize it's too much for you? And before you think I'm trying to rain on your parade, please know that I'm only saying this from years of experience. You won't believe how often I see this happen, and what a shame I think it is that we didn't give the student the best counsel. Because for every student in your situation who does become a pharmacist or doctor, there are 4 or 5 more who never make it into pharmacy or medical school, and then they have to turn around and start trying to become a nurse.
Nanny laughed and shook her head. The situation wasn't funny, but in a way it was.
I don't think I said anything funny, the dean said.
Did you grow up dreaming of having this job you have right now, Dean Flipkins?
Nanny asked, the funniness of the situation gone, replaced by a rage bubbling so ferociously within her that she was afraid it would spill out through her nose.
Actually, I had other dreams, but, you know, in life you have to...
That's why you don't want me to be a pharmacist, she said,
standing up and slinging her purse over her shoulder.
Because you are sitting in this office and not somewhere else.
Please have a seat, Miss Jonga,
the young man said, motioning to the chair.
There's no need to get...
I want to be a pharmacist,
Nanny said.
And I will become a pharmacist.
When Jende came home from work that night, she told him nothing of the conversation, except that she was likely not going to get any kind of scholarship. Then why are we still planning to go to the ceremony for this Honor Society thing? He asked in a tone that made her feel as if she'd sorely disappointed him.
Because it would be good to celebrate how far I've come, she responded.
But he was unconvinced. He wasn't going to take off work and lose money just to go watch her join an organization that wasn't going to help them. Go with one of your friends, he said to her, or ask Winston. Winston told her he would be delighted to attend when she called to invite him. He teased her about the accomplishment, saying she'd better make sure she was joining an honor society and not a secret society, because sometimes they looked the same. And she teased him back, saying the only secret society she would ever consider joining was the one he'd joined, which had taken him from Chicago grocery store cashier to Wall Street lawyer. Winston laughed, told her how proud he was of her, and on the day of the induction ceremony, he left work early to join her and Fatou and the kids in front of the auditorium. While Fatou stayed with Timba in the hallway, Winston and Leomi clapped and cheered as Nanny, alongside 28 other students, was formally inducted as a member of Phi Theta Kappa. After the ceremony, Winston took everyone to a sushi restaurant, where he ordered a platter of eel and avocado rolls, California rolls, and shrimp and cucumber rolls. He encouraged Fatou to have as much sake as she wanted, laughing with her as she downed it and slammed the cup on the table every time.
We enjoy like a this when she joined Societe,
Fatou said, giggling at her silly self for acting like the girls she'd seen on MTV.
What you gonna do when she becomes pharmacist?
He will take us to a restaurant in the Trump Hotel,
Nanny said, laughing, a spoonful of miso soup in one hand.
He will hire Donald Trump himself to cook steak for us.
Winston shook his head.
No,
he said, smiling at the fun the women were having at his expense.
The day this, our special girl, becomes a pharmacist, I will take everyone to a place called the Four Seasons.
Chapter 48 The rainy season in Limbe begins in April. The rain comes every few days for an hour or two,
not too heavy to stop the townsfolk from going outside, but heavy enough to force them to put on their chang shoes before braving the muddy streets. By May, the rains are heavier and times between downpours are cooler, though not so cool that the townsfolk have to put on sweaters just yet. The May rains tend to come at night, drumming so loudly on zinc roofs that some folks fear they will awaken to find their roofs lying on top of them. The night Pa Jonga died was one such rainy May night. His wife and children had spent all evening and the early part of the night rushing out in the unabating rain to the backyard kitchen to boil masepo and fever grass for him. They made him drink it, along with the paracetamol and nivakin the pharmacist at Half Mile had prescribed. The pharmacist had diagnosed Pa Jonga with either malaria or typhoid fever, and had asked that Pa Jonga be given the meds on a full stomach 3 times a day. Ma Jonga and her sons did everything the pharmacist said, but neither the white man's medicine nor the native medicine worked. Pa Ikola Jonga died at 4 in the morning, around the time of the neighborhood mosque's first call to prayer. Jende had 2 hours left before the end of his shift at the Hell's Kitchen restaurant when his middle brother, Moto, called him on his cell phone within an hour of the death. The old man's body was still lying warm on his bed.
"Papa don't die, you,"
Moto cried.
"Papa don't die."
The chef excused Jende for the rest of the night.
"I am so sorry for your loss," he said. "Please extend my condolences to the rest of your family in Africa."
Jende sat with his head down for the entire subway ride home, too stunned to cry. He found Neni wailing on her cell phone when he entered the apartment. Upon seeing him, she dropped the phone and ran into his arms to hold him. It was then the dam behind his eyelids broke.
"Papa, oh, papa," he cried. "How could you not give me one last chance to see you again? Eh, papa, how could you do this to me?" His nose, eyes, and mouth were spewing out liquid in all directions. "Why did you not wait for me, papa, eh? Why you do me so?"
Winston and his girlfriend, Mommy, came over just after midnight. Winston took off the day from work, and Mommy, who had recently moved to New York from Houston, after Winston had successfully wooed her back and immediately impregnated her, brought her laptop to do her accounting job in the bedroom. Many friends came over in the evening, the same friends who had come to dance when Timba was born. None of them asked if Jende would be going back home. They figured he would tell them if he was going, and if he wasn't going, well, no grown man should be made to tell anyone that he couldn't go home to bury his father. Pa Jonga was placed in the Limbe Provincial Mortuary and buried 2 weeks later. Jende sent the money for the funeral, a 2-day extravaganza of food and drinks, speeches and libations, dancing and singing and crying. It was an event that cost more money than Pa Jonga had made in the last 10 years of his life. His body, adorned in a white suit, was placed on a bed of bricks covered with a brand new white bedspread. All night, Ma Jonga sat on the floor beside the bed, dressed in a black kaba, nodding as sympathizers filed through the room to view the remains and encourage her to be strong.
"Asha, mama,"
they said.
"Thai heart, na so life deu, how man go do?"
The next day, the remains were blessed by the pastor of Mizpah Baptist Church, even though Pa Jonga had not been to church in decades. Ma Jonga had always wanted him to be baptized just like Jende and her other sons had been. She had envisioned the pastor dipping him into the little stream that flowed through the botanic garden, and then raising him out of the water as the congregation sang, "Ring the bells of heaven. There is joy today for a soul returning from the wild." But Pa Jonga wanted none of that church palaver. "When I die," he told his wife, "I'll go follow Jesus if I see him with my own 2 eyes." "Which church is going to agree to bless him now?" Jende had asked Moto as they talked about how they could give Pa Jonga one of the best funerals Newtown had ever seen.
No one with a grown child in America should have an ordinary funeral, the belief in Limbe went.
Any church that likes money will bless him,
Moto had replied.
I know you've already sent all the money you can, but if you could send a little more so we can give a nice envelope to a church, they'll be glad to send the apostle to bless him and send him straight to heaven.
For the first time in many days, Jende had laughed. He sent the money and learned the next day that Mispa Baptist Church had agreed to bless his father. Ma Jonga was still a staunch card-carrying parishioner of the church, as well as a member of its Kakane women's group. It was for her sake that the pastor agreed to come to the house and bless Pa Jonga on his journey to paradise. The money Jende had sent was not to pay the church, after all, but as a thanksgiving offering for his father's long, happy life. After the funeral service, the Kakane women's group, dressed in their social wrappers, led the mourners in a march from the house to the graveyard. A hired marching band followed the women, and then came the rented Land Rover bearing Pa Jonga's brass-handled casket. Behind the Land Rover, a two-mile-long cluster of family and friends marched, some with framed portraits of Pa Jonga lifted high above their heads. They marched and they danced and they wailed all through Newtown and through the market, crying and singing, Yondo, 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 swelele. Jende watched it all on the video he had asked Moto to have made. He watched the six-hour DVD collection in one sitting. He saw his mother collapse in grief when the casket opened to reveal his father's body, after it had been brought home for the wake. He listened to the speeches about what a good man Pa Jonga was, and what a fine farmer and drafts player, too. He watched the dances that went on from late Friday night to early Saturday morning. He listened to the pastor's sermon in the house, a sermon about how neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, neither the present nor the future, nor any powers, neither height nor depth, nor anything else in all creation can separate God's children from his love. Jende watched the moment when his father was lowered into the ground, and the pastor bellowed, Ikola Jonga, from dust you came, to dust you will return. His sorrow at not being able to bury his father was as heavy as his grief at the death. Every scene in the grainy video made him cry, except the ones where he was too astonished at the weight gained, or gray hair developed, or teeth lost by certain friends and family members, people he hadn't seen in almost 5 years. The day after he watched the video, his back began to ache. He had to leave one job early one afternoon and call off the other job in the evening. The pain in his feet seemed to have traveled to his back, only with more ferocity. He spent many mornings before work lying on the floor, writhing in pain, swallowing as many as 5 Tylenol capsules at a time. A colleague referred him to a cash-only doctor in Jamaica, Queens, who charged him $60 for a 20-minute consultation, after informing him that the accident health insurance plan Nenny had bought for them online, after her eligibility for the state's free prenatal care assistance program ended, was pretty much useless. The children were both receiving insurance through Child Health Plus at no cost, thankfully. In a windowless basement office, the doctor examined him and told him his pains might be stress-induced. Are you dealing with any major stressors in your life? He asked Jende. Am I dealing with any major stressors in my life? Jende wanted to say. Yes, doctor. Turns out I am. In a few weeks, I am due to stand in front of an immigration judge to continue begging him to please not deport me. My father just died, and I could not bury him. What could be a bigger shame for a firstborn son? My mother is getting too old to be breeding pigs and farming and selling in the market, so I have to start sending her money more frequently. I have a wife and 2 children who I need to feed and clothe and shelter every day. My wife is supposed to return to school to keep her student visa, and I don't know if I'll be able to afford her international student tuition by washing dishes at restaurants. She may have to drop out of school and live without any kind of papers.
Maybe she'll end up in front of an immigration judge, too, begging to please be allowed to remain in the country so she can find a way to finish her school. Forget about school. We don't even have enough to cook a good meal with chicken some days. I am holding on tightly to my savings so that I'll be ready for the day when worst comes to worst. But now I ask myself, what am I saving it for? The worst has come to the worst, and my back is breaking. So yes, doctor, I have many major stressors in my life.
Chapter 49. He knew it was over the moment he walked out of the doctor's office. That night, after work, he asked Nanny to sit down at the dinette. He took her hand and looked deep into her eyes.
Nanny, he began.
What's wrong? What did the doctor say?
Nanny, he called her name again.
Jende, please.
I'm ready to go back home, he said.
Home where? What do you mean by go back home?
He took a deep breath and was silent for several seconds.
Home to Limbe, he said to his wife. I want to go back to Limbe.
She pulled her hand from his and shifted backward in her chair, as if he just revealed that he had a vile, contagious disease.
What's the meaning of all this? She asked.
Her voice was angry.
I don't want to stay in this country anymore.
You want us to pack up our things and go back to Limbe? Is that what you are saying?
He nodded, looking at her sorrowfully, like a child pleading for mercy. She peered into his eyes, bloodshot and heavy eyes that seemed to belong to a sick, broken man. When he tried to take her hand into his again, she shifted farther away from him and put them behind her back.
You want to return to Limbe?
Yes.
Why? Why are you talking like this, Jende? What's the meaning of all this?
I don't like what my life has become in this country.
I don't know how long I can continue living like this, Nanny. The suffering in Limbe was bad, but this one here, right now, it's more than I can take.
Nanny Jonga stared at her husband as if wanting to feel sympathy, but capable of feeling only irritation.
Is it something the doctor said? She asked. Is it because of your back?
No. I mean, it's not only because of my back.
It's everything, Nanny. Have you not seen how unhappy I've been? Of course, Bebe. I've seen how you've been unhappy, but your father died, and you have been in mourning. Anyone who loves their father the way you loved your father would be unhappy.
But it's not only my father's death. It's everything that's happened. I lost my job, my papier situation. This work all the time. For what? For a little money?
How much suffering can a man take in this world, eh? How much longer?
His voice broke at the end of his question, but he cleared his throat to push it out.
You know we can get through anything, gents, Nanny said, taking his hand. We've been through so much. You know we'll be okay, right?
He shook his head.
No, he said. I don't know if I'll be okay. I'm trying really hard, but I don't know if my life will get better in this country. How long will I keep on washing dishes?
Only until you get your papier.
That's not true, he said with a sad shake of his head. Papier is not everything. In America today, having documents is not enough. Look at how many people with papers are struggling. Look at how even some Americans are suffering. They were born in this country. They have American passports, and yet they are sleeping on the street, going to bed hungry, losing their jobs and houses every day in this economic crisis.
Timba started whimpering in the bedroom. They stopped talking, looking past each other as they waited for her to put herself back to sleep. She did.
Having papers in this country is not everything, Jende continued.
What do you think is going to change with my life if I get papers tomorrow?
You will get a better